The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on tracking our moods. Many people use check-in apps on their smartphones to let their friends and followers know that they've frequented a hot night spot or a popular restaurant. But a new study has people checking in with their emotions. So, Dave, why might we need to check in with ourselves a few times a day?
Well, Sarah, this study is all about depression. One of the problems with depression is that it's hard to combat unless you get an advance sense that it's going to happen. So researchers are trying to find a way to anticipate when people are going to not just be depressed, but really have these major depressive episodes that can lead to long-term depression.
So why might collecting the emotions from someone multiple times a day help with that?
Well, one idea is that there may be a tipping point for depression. In other words, there may be a lot of little things that happen during the day that push us over the edge to depression, but researchers weren't really sure what that was, and hence the idea of checking in with people many times a day.
So how many people did they have checking in on themselves?
Well, they recruited 600 people. Some were healthy, some had a diagnosis of depression, and they asked them to track their emotions for about 5 or 6 days. And what they did was 10 times a day at random intervals, these people were wearing a watch that would beep. And whenever it would beep, the subjects had to write down what their mood was. Was it cheerful, content, sad, anxious? You get the idea. 6 to 8 weeks later, the participants filled out a more detailed questionnaire that rated their levels of clinical depression.
And so was there a correlation between those measurements on the day and then months later?
There was. So what the researchers found was that after the end of the follow-up period, about 13% of the subjects had experienced a shift toward being more depressed, which is about what you'd see in the general population. But what was more interesting was that this shift from a healthy state to a depressed state resembled tipping points that had been seen with other phenomena, such as changes to Earth's climate or even social trends, things that go viral, for example.
So they were actually able to see the accumulation of these hits, like these states of anxiety, these states of sadness building up over time, and then could actually say, we can make a prediction off that data.
Exactly. An example they give is if a healthy person has an unpleasant call with their employer, they'll be unhappy about it and they'll maybe dwell on it for 10 to 20 minutes, then they'll get over it. But people that experience these longer term episodes of depression would dwell on these very negative experiences. And these were things that the researchers picked up on during the study, was that these negative moods persisted when the people kept on checking in on themselves several times a day. They had a much harder time shaking these negative moods, and that would ultimately push them over this tipping point into a much more major depressive episode.
Is there a use for this outside of the laboratory? Is this something people might actually turn into an app?
Well, exactly. And that you might actually see that because, again, the problem with treating depression is really anticipating it. And so if this research leads to a better way to anticipate these depressive episodes, then people might be able to seek therapy or take drugs before the depression actually sets in, which would make it easier to treat.
Next up, we have a story on how our diet influences our gut microbes. We talk a lot about our microbial friends on this podcast, what they help us with and how many there are all over our skin, inside of our bodies. In fact, they almost seem at times to be in charge. So, well, this latest study actually turns the tables, Dave. Why did these researchers wrest control from these tiny tyrants?
Well, right. So this study actually shows that there may be a way for us to control our microbes, our gut microbes, rather than vice versa. As you mentioned, Sarah, gut microbes have been linked to everything from autism to obesity. So they clearly play a very important role in our body, although most of those links have been done in mice, and they haven't been tested as well in humans. One of the reasons is because researchers have long thought that it's very hard for us to change the composition of our gut microbes. There's not just one type of bacteria in our guts. There's tons of different types of bacteria in our guts. And it was thought that it would take weeks or even months to change the composition of these bacteria, and that would be hard to do a study with. But this new study suggests that it's actually fairly easy for us to change these populations of microbes in our guts and exactly what these microbes are doing as well.
basically they had to get people to change their diets, right?
They did. And they actually took 10 people and they put half of them on a really hardcore carnivore diet. They had to eat basically only pork, cheese, ribs, brisket, salami, pork rinds.
Do they have to pay for that? That's a lot of meat.
And the vegetarians comprised the other half of the group, and they were put on a very veggie, high-fiber diet, beans, rice, things like that. And the scientists were amazed to find that just in the course of just 4 days, the microbial populations in the guts of these two groups were very different.
Well, what kind of difference do they notice? Do they see an influx of a new type of bacteria in their guts?
Well, not really new types of bacteria, but they saw a rise in certain species of bacteria in the meat eaters versus the vegetarians. And it wasn't just the relative populations of these species. It was what these bacteria were doing. For example, in the meat eaters, they saw that there were bacteria that were known to tolerate high levels of bile, which the body secretes to digest meat. There were much more of these types of bacteria. And not only that, but the gene activity in some of these bacteria reflected how the bacteria were metabolizing food. So, for example, in those eating meat, genes involved in the breaking down of proteins increased their activity. And similarly, in the vegetarians, genes that were important for digesting carbohydrates became much more active.
Is there a recommendation that can be made from these findings? Should people eat more or less of any one of these foods?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, because a lot of these bacteria have been linked to disease, you might think, well, all I have to do is start eating a lot of meat or a lot of veggies, and all of a sudden I can counteract things like autism. And the researchers say we're not anywhere close to that yet. But what this does show is that we do have a lot more control over this microbial population than we thought. The question is exerting that control, will that actually lead to good consequences or bad consequences? Some of these bacteria have actually been linked to inflammatory bowel disease. So you certainly wouldn't want to radically change your diet based on this one study because you could actually cause more problems.
Finally, we have a story on how earthquakes spread. There are still many mysteries about the behavior of earthquakes, but here's a new one. How are earthquakes like forest fires, Dave?
Well, the answer isn't simple, but there is an answer, and it turns out earthquakes actually do share some similarity with forest fires. This all gets back to the fact that earthquakes show a surprising statistical regularity. Larger ones occur less frequently than smaller ones. And for more than half a century, scientists have known that earthquakes of magnitude 2 occur roughly one-tenth as often as those of magnitude 1. Those of magnitude 3 occur about one-tenth the rate as those of magnitude 2, and so on. So there is this interesting mathematical relationship between the frequency and the size of earthquakes. So it seems like a fairly straightforward correlation. But one problem with this model of earthquakes is that it leaves out aftershocks. It doesn't really account, for example, for how often aftershocks happen.
Okay, so let's bring in the forest fires. How do those fit into maybe tweaking this model of earthquake frequency?
Well, there was a researcher in Argentina who thinks that there is some similarity between the way forest fires spread and the way aftershocks, quote unquote, spread after earthquakes. And what he did was he tried to see if he could apply a similar model that had applied to earthquakes to forest fires. And he basically created this model where trees sprout at random on a square grid. It's like a vast checkerboard. And once the forest gets dense enough, lightning sets a random tree on fire, and the fire spreads instantaneously among the trees that occupy the adjacent squares. This conflagration continues until there are no more neighbors to jump to, and the process starts all over again. So applying this to earthquakes, all of a sudden the forest is the plane of a fault cutting through Earth's crust, and sprouting trees correspond to the buildup of stress along the fault. Burning areas correspond to the part of the fault that moves during a quake. Now, when he applied this model, it didn't match exactly what was seen with earthquakes, so he tweaked things a little bit. He actually introduced two different types of trees. One, which he called A trees, that burn instantly, and B trees that burn more slowly and only light their neighbors up after a small delay. And the fire pauses when it has to hit one of these B trees as a consequence. The result is that the forest fire breaks into a cluster of smaller fires, slightly separated in time, that reduces the frequency of really big fires. When he did this, the model of the spread of forest fires matched very closely the distribution of earthquake sizes.
So this is something they were able to compare to real-world data?
Well, the researchers showed that if he looked at California quake data over the past 20 years, he did see a similar correlation to what he was seeing in his model, in his forest fire model. But earthquake researchers, though they think this is interesting, say there's been a lot of attempts to correlate the statistics in earthquakes to other things. This is just the latest, and it's unclear what impact this will have on both understanding the spread of earthquakes and even possibly predicting them.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about ways to prevent birds from crashing into airplanes called bird strike. Also a story about why the animal family tree trunk may be made of jelly. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got an item about how a new U.S. budget deal could spare some very tough cuts for scientific research funding. Also, a follow-up to our story from last week about efforts to grant chimpanzees legal personhood in U.S. courts. Those efforts have failed, and we talk a little bit about what happens next. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about efforts to understand the origins of human disease by digging up the bones in a 1,000-year graveyard. And we'll be taking a brief hiatus for Science Live for the rest of December, returning in early January. Be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi.